serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Bob Izumi of Barstow, California. Two-thirds of his nearly 93 years on this planet have been spent actively connected to one branch of service or another. It's been 10 years now since he retired from the Wood Rock Hobby Shop at Marine Corps Logistics Base Barstow. He's busy in retirement, too, putting those woodworking and lapidary skills to continual good use. We've heard some of his stories from Bastogne, Belgium, where he survived that snowy siege during the Battle of the Bulge, and even a little from his Air Force career that spanned the Korean War, the Cold War, and Vietnam. He shared briefly about the things he saw when his unit liberated a concentration camp in World War II, but in Korea he witnessed another humanitarian crisis. Caves near his base had become dumping grounds for infants.
The Korean lady who was pregnant would have their baby there, and they would leave their babies in that because they were, I guess the Korean culture, if they weren't married legally, it's very bad. So they would take that, have the baby and take it someplace.
So you found babies?
So we found babies and take them to Chinguan Orphanage. I received the humanitarian award.
We're not talking just one baby.
Oh, no, not one baby, a whole bunch of babies.
Oh, man, that's got to just tear your heart apart.
Oh, it did.
But you guys went in and you saved all those babies' lives.
Right.
Got them to the orphanage.
Right.
And who knows where they are today?
I tried to find them, but I can't.
They'd be in their 60s now.
Oh, more than that. You were talking about that. I saved a little boy. I got a picture of him. We called him Snowball. Aubrey Jackson and I saw him in the snow.
This is in World War II?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I said, look at that guy out there. That boy. He's naked and he's in the snow. So Aubrey said, let's go get him. So I got him. In German, he said, what's his name? I said, what's your name? And he went like this. So Aubrey says, I know, we'll name him Snowball. So we took GI blankets and made a suit for him. I got a picture of him. And as of today, General Patton's daughter is trying to find this guy. He might be gone by now, but I don't know.
Wow. So you stay in the Air Force through the Korean War and through the Vietnam War as well?
Yes, sir.
And you made a statement earlier, you and your son were both in Vietnam.
Right. He was 30 miles south of where I was.
What did that feel like? Were you more concerned for yourself or for your son?
No, just for my son. My wife knows how old he is. He's pretty old.
And what were you doing in Vietnam?
I was a control tower in Seoul.
And you got a Bronze Star for something you did over there?
Saving a pilot.
How'd you do that?
In Vietnam, they say Americans are not supposed to be there. So if this pilot went down, you know what DF is?
Tell us.
Direction finder.
Uh-huh.
He mayday'd and I found out where he was. And in Vietnam, you had to go through village 1, 2, 3, 4 village chiefs to get okay for me to go in there to get him. But the chief says, negative, you can't go in there. So I went to my commanding officer, and my commanding officer, what'd you do? Did the village chief say no? I said, that's right. He said, okay, you can't go in there. So I went back, and I hit the button, I didn't care, and scrambled a Huey to go get him. And he got him, and I got reprimanded for him, and he turns around and gives me a Bronze Star.
So the same person reprimanded you and gave you the Bronze Star?
Yeah.
Because he had to reprimand you?
Yeah.
Because you didn't follow protocol.
Right.
But you saved his life.
Saved the pilot life. I'm not that way. The man who went in there saved the life.
But if you hadn't done that, the helicopter wouldn't have gone.
Right.
And he would have been captured.
Yeah, right. He would have been captured or been killed.
But he might still be missing over there, so many thousands are.
Why are we there for? I saw, you know who Jimmy Stewart is?
Sure.
I saw him fly an A-1 out of that base and go on a mission.
You know, a lot of people don't know that. He flew bombing missions in World War II.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
But they don't know about what he did in Vietnam.
Yes, sir.
He was an older man.
He flew missions. I saw him going into the A-1.
What does that say about the kind of person he was?
Wonderful. People don't know that. He did that. Raymond Burr?
Uh-huh.
He was there. He was entertaining the troops.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Perry Mason goes to Vietnam.
Yeah. Uh-huh. See, people don't know that.
How long did you stay in the Air Force?
30 years.
And you would think, 442 and the 101st Airborne, two of the most legendary units of World War II, then not out of the service very long at all, into the Army Air Corps, it turns into the Air Force, you stay in for 30 more years, they would think, hey, that's enough. This guy's done enough for our country. He can get away from all this military stuff. But not you. That's not what you thought.
I love the service. I would die in the service if they let me.
Yeah, you'd go back in right now.
I sure would.
Right? So tell us what you found next as a way to serve our country and to serve our military personnel.
Well, I stayed in the Air Force, met Neil Armstrong. I flew with Neil Armstrong.
Flew where? Flew what?
Flew an F-51 tandem. He was the pilot and I was in the back.
Oh, you're the passenger behind.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how did you get to do that? How did you get to fly in the back seat with Neil Armstrong flying that Mustang?
I asked him, I said, I'd like to fly in that Mustang once because I know I love that Mustang. I'll show it later on. So I said, sure, sure. Flew with him in there.
And this was long before he became the first man on the moon.
Yes. You know who the first man into space is? Gagarin is the first man who flew in there. But who beat him in the space?
Alan Shepard?
Mr. Robert White, Colonel White.
Oh, that's right. Uh-huh.
He flew the X-15 and held it. And yeah. He's the first man to get the astronaut wings from the president.
Uh-huh.
Most people don't know that either. Well, I knew him when he was a captain. And I knew Captain Kinchlow. He was the first man to be picked as an astronaut. He got killed on a 104.
Was this all at Edwards?
Yes, sir. That flew three times the speed of sound with Mr. Johnson in a B-58.
Three times the speed of sound? As a passenger?
Yes, as a radio operator. I think about things like that, but like most of the people I know are gone, like Captain Kinchlow, Colonel White's gone, Mr. Johnson's gone, Captain App, Merlin App. He flew the X-2, and that's my opinion now. I think Chuck Yeager did not go through the barrier. I think somebody else did way before. But since it was an Air Force base and political-wise, they gave it to Chuck Yeager.
So you think someone did it before Yeager did and just didn't get out?
Yeah.
Is there someone you want to give the credit to? Do you know who it was?
No.
You just know it happened because you heard the boom or what?
No, just know what happened.
What aren't you telling me here?
I just don't want to give that name.
So you know who it is, but you don't want to out that person?
Yeah.
Then, I bet there are some other things that most people don't know that you became privy to at Edwards.
Yeah, well, they had what you call North Edwards. I was in charge of that control tower in the North Edwards. And I was picked to go there because I was NCOIC.
That means non-commissioned officer in charge?
Right. So I went there. We had a control tower. We'd have an aircraft take off out of there. It was pitch black. You can't tell who it was. So then I'd go and clearing for takeoff, and I'd lock up the control tower and go back. It was just like Area 51.
There are a lot of experimental things going on there.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
That were top secret.
Yeah.
You got any UFO stories then?
Have I? Yes, sir. I got one. And I was in charge of the control tower in Norton Air Force Base, and a guy named Sergeant Roop and I were on duty. And Desotels, A, B, and C position. And then I saw this great big white light over Dock 1. I said, Roop, you didn't have a camera or nothing? He said, no. He said, look at that white light there. And it just hovered there. Didn't make no noise. So Norton, across away, was AC&W, radar. We call him up there and says, do you see that object on top of the stock? He says, yeah, we see it. We see it on our radar. So the lieutenant, he says, that'll be right up. Anyway, in the control tower, we have what you call a form 1132. Every hour or on the hour or every minute, anything unusual, we type it in. So I typed it in and everything. Then when the lieutenant started coming up, that doggone light went toward Cajon Pass. And the lieutenant came in and says, where's that form you typed? He says, you can't take it. I said, you can't take it without my commanding officer. Sorry. Pulled the sheet out. He said, you didn't see that thing, did you?
Wow.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
So the implication is he knows what it is.
Yeah.
He doesn't want anybody to know about it.
Yeah. Then the one I saw in Oxnard Air Force Base on the south side was a big mountain there. There was a light there, and we saw it there. And so I hit the button, what you call alert to hangars, and they had F-86s, and the F-86 went up, chased him, and he couldn't catch him. That's the only two I seen.
What do you think those were? Were those American experiments?
I don't know. If it was an American experiment or not. I think we have things that, I mean, why should we'll say I'm a test pilot, why should I tell the nation what I'm flying?
Especially, why should you let your enemies find out?
Yeah, same thing.
Sure. And I'm not trying to put thoughts in your head. I'm just wondering what your, because you saw it, I didn't. I'm just wondering what your opinion is. Because, you know, you hear people late at night on the radio and they say, oh, those are the people from outer space. You hear others who say, no, it's all governments here that are spending a lot of money testing experimental aircraft.
Well, I think we have something to do with it.
You think?
Because I've seen it.
Sure. And that lieutenant tearing up your paper, I mean.
No, he just took it.
He didn't tear it up. He just took it from you.
Right.
And then even after you got out of the Air Force, you said, okay, I've already checked off the Army and the Air Force. Why don't I get involved with the Marine Corps?
I did.
Tell me what you did.
Well, a fellow named Mr. Hedberg Gunny, he came up to Travis Air Force Base and says, I'm here to interview you for a job for the U.S. Marines. So he talked to me and he says, well, you got pretty good qualification. Why don't you come on down since you are in the service now and come into the Marines? So I told my wife and I drove down there and I liked what I did. I taught Marines how to make furniture out of pallets.
So leftover pallets from forklifting things around.
Right, and those pallets were made out of oak, maple, purple heartwood. I'll show you what I made out of it.
So you spent how many years doing this?
30.
30 years teaching Marines woodworking.
Yes, sir.
Where did you learn?
I learned how to do woodworking and lapidary work in Korea.
30 years. I mean, you just stopped in your 80s.
Yes, sir.
What were you getting out of that? Why were you doing that?
Because I love the service and I love the people in uniform.
So all those years where you were teaching woodworking, is this to give these Marines something to do when they get out of the service or to pass their time while
just
they're
pass
in?
Them time while they're there.
So what kinds of things would they end up making?
Like that coffee table there. I made this table. It's all out of pallets.
Wow. You wouldn't think a beautiful table like that could come out of pallets. That's my kind of recycling. So you did that for 30 years?
Yes, sir.
On the Marine Corps base?
Yes, sir.
What made you decide to finally let that go and stop doing that?
I can't think of his name. He says, 30 years is enough. If I had my way, I would still stay there.
Because this was a job.
Yeah.
This wasn't volunteer work.
No.
This is a government job to run that
and
program.
And I loved it.
And you'd still be doing it right now if they let you.
Well, I do it at home, yeah.
Yeah, now you do it for yourself.
Yeah.
Well, there's probably a lot of people out there who've got a Bob Azumi original somewhere.
Oh, right, yes. House, huh? Quite a few teachers that I met, they still have. I made baby cradles.
What a gift to so many people. And you mentioned being a guest of honor. You've been the guest of honor at a lot of places. You went to Washington, D.C. when all the Japanese-American veterans of World
right.
War II were given the Congressional Gold Medal, the highest civilian honor. And there you met President Barack Obama. But many, many years earlier, you met another president of the United States before he was president.
Eisenhower.
What was Ike like?
Mr. Ike was very, I can't explain it. But I think Mr. Patton was much better than Ike. He would stop and say, how's everything going?
This is Patton you're talking about?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. But that president, General Ike, he would just, I would just saluting him with my rifle and he'd walk in. That's it. But General Patton would, boy, I'll never forget it because he would stop and say hello and say, how are you doing? You need any help? But he would be there. I was there when he was hit by the weapons carrier. Every year I go, Helen Patton would give me the honor to lay the wreath.
You've been a lot of places, done a lot of things.
No.
I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country for so long, and thank you for giving us a little taste of some of your adventures. Is there one part of all of it, of this whole life experience, which is pretty hard to believe that a guy who had 4C enemy aliens stamped on him has done all this for our country and for the rest of us? Is there any part of all of that that you would say you're most proud of today?
I'm proud to be an American. I see a flag flying. Boy, I'd salute that flag every time, anywhere. Mm-hmm. But most people, they won't do that.
Well, maybe they will now after they heard you say it.
No, no.
What is it about this country that you love so much that you think other people should maybe feel the same way?
Freedom. They don't know what freedom is until they take it away from you.
And that happened to you.
Yes, that's why I do it again. I don't know when I walk by and everything. If I don't know you and you, I'll go walk by and I'll tell my wife, just a minute. She says, I know what you're going to do. So I'll go up to you and say, what do you look so sad for? And then all of a sudden you smile. Oh, that's good. Thank you very much. And you're smiling. When I go to a restaurant, I was eating, and I saw this man pull the chair out for this lady. So I told my wife, will you excuse me? He said, I know what you're going to go. So I went over to the gentleman. I says, may I say something? It's very unusual these days for a gentleman to pull a chair out for the lady. And I said, thank you. And I walked away. 10 minutes later, here comes a bottle of champagne. I don't drink. Yeah, it's true. Things like that. People are not happy nowadays, if you look at it. People seem to have a negative attitude. Why? Before you know it, you're going to be 90-something years old like I am. Before you know it, I'll be gone.
Well, I guess that's the only other question I have to ask you, Bob. Your life story is so colorful.
No, it's not colorful.
Oh, it sure sounds like
no,
it.
Oh, yeah.
You've been through some incredible things. You've met some very famous people, even today. They want you at the Dodger game or the Angel game to throw out the first pitch, and 50,000 people are giving you a standing ovation. And
right.
Presidents want you to come to Washington, and everybody wants you to go somewhere. Is there something you haven't done yet that you're still looking forward to, that you want to do?
No, I think the good Lord there. I didn't believe in the good Lord until maybe a few years ago. But during the war, I got the Bible there. a guy named George, I can't think of his name, he gave me a little Bible, and I still have it. And he underlined what I should, if I get in trouble. I say that going through Jim Skugel and Bastogne.
So what changed? You had that for 70 years before it meant anything to you?
Yeah, I didn't. That the verse meant a lot, but I didn't realize that there is somebody or somebody upstairs is much, much, he has to be superior.
I don't want to pin you down or anything.
No, go ahead, pin me down.
So they gave you a Bible in World War II, but you said only until a few years ago you didn't believe in the good Lord. But now your perspective is what? That he's been looking out for you this whole time?
Yes, yes.
Do you see evidence of that now when you look back? Do you see situations where you say, maybe he intervened on my behalf there?
Yes, yes. Why did I save children that I don't know? Why did he give me the courage to do that? Why did he give me the courage to continue 30-some years in the service? Why am I talking to you when I'm 90-some years old? People think I'm in my 60s. I don't feel like I'm 90, but I appreciate it. People better enjoy life because it's really short.
Words of wisdom from a man who has had quite the journey. That's Bob Izumi of Barstow, California. Photos of Bob and links to some of the many articles about his unique military distinctions are up for you at hometownheroesradio.com. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we hear from another veteran like Bob who knows what it's like to live behind barbed wire, in his case, as a prisoner of war. We will be reminded again, as we were today, that freedom is not free.